So recently I was able to sit down with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller and talk about all manner of stuff. And hopefully you picked up that episode. It was just 2 weeks ago. And if you didn't, you should go pick it up. We talked about all manner of stuff. But the focus point or the goal of that was to dig into his new work that he's been preparing for Concordia Publishing House, which, you know, he gave the title. I don't remember the title. I remember what I told him he should title it after the conversation, and maybe he'll change that. But it really inspired me a little bit to dig more into this question of the craft of writing, and particularly where it runs into what we believe or worldview development. There's a guy named Craig Parton who wrote a book a while ago called The Defense Never Rests. And I don't know, I'm talking to my guest already a little bit, if you've ever heard that book or seen that book. But one of the points he makes in that book is that there is a need for apologetics, for the defense of the faith, and not only for the hardcore facts and order and science-based apologetics, but also for what he called a soft apologetic. And he used C.S. Lewis's Narnia Chronicles as his example of a soft apologetic, something that kind of gets in the soul through the back door a little bit and can bring people into spiritual conversations or spiritual thought when they're not, they have their defenses down, right? So I'm really curious about that. As an author who now, I've had two books published from CPH, Broken and Echo. They're doing fine. But I don't know about how many of you listeners know this. Some of you maybe remember that over the last year, I released snippets of a fiction novel as audio podcasts. The novel's called Earth. You can go back and find that in the podcast if you want. But Earth, which is still unfinished and not even close to being finished, is probably the third attempt I've had at fiction. I still have the original draft of the full book I wrote when I was 21 years old. It's called The Crux, and it's about some weird drug runner in a futuristic dystopian society who falls through the middle of the planet, and then it was terrible. So I tried to rewrite it and then stopped halfway through and never got anywhere in that. Point being in all of this, my heart as a human being is to write fiction. It's actually what I wanted to be when I was 16. It's what I went to school to do. It's what I've always desired to do, to be a writer. And so when Scott Kinneman of Concordia Publishing House reached out to me and said, hey, you want to write a book for us? This was way back, Worldview Everlasting Days. It ends up being Broken. What his question was, have you ever thought about writing? And I'm just like, yeah, it's all I've ever wanted to do. So as I've done this now and realized, okay, apparently I can pull this off, I've also begun to learn that you can study more than just studying writing. You can study the craft or the technique of making yourself write or continuing to write. Because, and Brian and I got into this quite a bit with the difference between a blog post, an article, and a book, right? A sprint and a slog. You know? So to make that long story short, I want to do more of that kind of conversation. And today, not because I planned it, but because my wife happens to just be friends with this person, I have another author sitting here in my studio with me, and she's graciously agreed to have a conversation about this very kind of thing. So I would like you to meet, if you don't already know, Mrs. Katie Schuerman. Did I get it right? Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah. She is the wife of Pastor Michael Schuerman, who is the pastor of Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Sherman, Illinois. But you might also know her name as the author of the Anthems of Zion trilogy from Concordia Publishing House. And this is, I think, one of the first attempts. When it first came out, CPH had not done fiction for a while. And I don't know if you were the first or close to the first attempt to go back into fiction. But this is a fictional stories about a small town and the pastor and family and Christians who live at a church in that, or who go to a church in that small town. I have never read these books, and I've confessed this to Katie already. I'm probably not the target audience for these books either.
I also properly shamed him for that he has not read them.
Yeah. But my wife adores these books, and I don't know if she's ever told you this, she compares them to The Hammer of God.
That blesses me, because that's what I'm trying to do.
So, okay, before I go further, I can talk about the other books you've done, but what are you trying to do?
I remember reading Hammer of God. It was probably in 2004, maybe 2005. My husband gave it to me to read. And I remember the first chapter trying to slog through it because I think in the translation, it's not very compelling in the first chapter.
It's a weird environment.
It is.
You're like, where did I land?
Yes.
What foreign planet is this?
What is this costume he's wearing at this dinner party?
Yeah.
And what is he? Yeah.
Yeah.
And what happened, of course, is in the telling of the story of, let's say, the first pastor, because there are three pastors that Hammer of God addresses, I just saw myself not in his pastoral vocation, but as a Christian who thinks that I know everything there is to know about our Lord and about his word. And then suddenly you encounter a person in true crisis and how that changes how we know God. We know God in the good times. Those of us raised in the Midwest are very familiar with the theology of glory. We know that all good things come from God, and we assume that only good things come from God. And when we come up against suffering, sometimes we're not equipped with an understanding of who is God in that suffering, what is his role, who is he to us when we're in such pain. And having the character of the pastors encounter suffering that he himself did not understand, and not only as a pastor but just as a person, and then suddenly being in the role of shepherd of having to interpret that through the word of God, he came up with he didn't have the right answers. And that a lay woman who had been properly catechized, not only I would say in the word of God but also in the school of life, isn't that true of those who are older than us? They are wise in their experiences. They've encountered death. They've encountered life. They've encountered sickness. They've encountered mental illness. They've encountered all these things that we in our theology of glory assume we won't experience because we're true Christians. She then lovingly, truthfully preaches to the pastor by caring for this person in his crisis. And I was so deeply moved by that. And I don't just mean emotionally. I mean, my faith was shored up. And I thought, this is a fictional story. Stories can do this. Stories can speak so directly about God and who he is to us and who we are to him. And I think I fell in love with the theology of the cross. In Hammer of God. And honestly, the book ended and I was in crisis.
In your life?
Yeah, in crisis insofar as like, well, what am I going to read next?
Oh, yeah.
Because what is going to compare to this? There are so many wonderful books. My new favorite, because, you know, you read something and it becomes your next favorite, is Count of Monte Cristo. That book is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's magnificent. It's epic. And there's theology of the cross in it. But there are not characters that speak so directly the word of God to the sinner and to the person who doubts or to the person who has too much pride, as Bo Geertz was able to do through the voices of these pastors and his parishioners. And so all that to say then, when my opportunity came to write fiction, my husband, who is a wise man, he said, I think you should write something that you want to read. And I think you should write about what you know. And it's a common understanding when you're a creative person that the more confines you have, actually the more freedom there is creatively. Sometimes when you're staring into empty space and you have too many choices creatively, you just get stuck. You get overwhelmed by the world of imagination and ideas. But if you can have some kind of stricture put onto your creative time, suddenly the ideas have direction. And that's what my husband did for me. He gave me structure. He said, first of all, write what you want to read. I want to read Hammer of God. And I also was missing in literature vignette-ish writing, which is this idea of each chapter is its own story. Kind of maybe you could call it fable writing. L.M. Montgomery, she's a Canadian author. She's most famous for Anne of Green Gables, but she excelled at this vignette-ish style of writing. And what she was able to do is she was able to take these vignettes through regionalism. She focused on a very specific point in the world. And regionalism, I like to think of as exoticism. Mark Twain did this too about river life, right? We all are fascinated to read about this culture he's writing about because we don't live it. And so while he's creative, while he's brilliant, while he's witty, we're also learning about a distinct group of people at the time. And that's what Ella Montgomery does. She teaches us about Canadian island life through Anne of Green Gables, through these little vignettes. And since she's couching her story in these fascinating elements, in these accessible elements, she's actually able to write about very difficult things. Being an orphan, being abused, being a woman who was never given the gift of a husband, being the subject of gossip, things that actually are, you know, we're so used to those, like gossip, we are like, whatever, that happens to everybody. Yeah, when you're the object of gossip, your reputation is killed. And that's a devastating, life-altering experience, and you hope that your reputation will be resurrected, but not always. So she's able to write about these very difficult things in ways that we're not offended when we confront them. She's able to instruct us through them because she's couching these difficult things through humor, through experiences that we all relate to, through characters that we know because they're our neighbors. We live right next to them. And so I loved that vignette-ish style of writing, but I loved the truth and the depth, the opportunity that Bogert shows us that in fiction you can actually truly directly quote the word of God.
Right.
You can apply theology to specific situations in the life of the Christian. So that's what I wanted to write. And then my husband said, write about what you know. Well, I'm a musician by trade. I'm not a writer. I love writing. I've always been writing because I'm blessed to be an American with an education. And I'm blessed that in my jobs as teacher and as performer, there are always opportunities to be working with words, with text. So I've never had a point in my life where I wasn't involved with words in some regard, but I never really applied myself creatively just to the task of writing a book. I like to think of my life in terms of decades, and in my 20s, I was primarily a musician. In my 30s, I was primarily a writer. But to me, it's all the same thing. It's all creativity. It's all communication. It's all listening to something and then communicating something back, often through whether I'm speaking it or writing it. So I decided to write about a Lutheran church musician. And with those strictures, I had boundless creative opportunity. And it was just tight enough of a hole for me to, you know, put that viewfinder up to my eye and see very clearly the story I wanted to write. I think if I'd not had those strictures, I would have spent time treading water for a long time trying to figure out what to write. And that's a lesson I've learned as a writer. It's actually, I think it's dangerous to spend too much time treading water. Trying to think, well, what do I want to write about? Well, that's just not the most important question. What can you write about? What do you have to say? What do you know? What can you share with people? Writing is communicating. What gifts has God given you? What special insights has he given you? What experiences has he given you that you actually have something to share? And or are you a person who actually you're gifted in research? Well, then you're probably not going to write about what you know. You're going to write about what hobby you've picked up on
recently. What you want to know.
What you want to know, yeah. And so, and sometimes they're combined. But I wanted to write a book that was accessible, that was funny, that was smart, that was real. And for me, it's very important that a book has heart. I think...
what do you mean by that?
Yes. When you watch some sitcoms on television, they might be witty. They might be clever. They might be funny. But if there's not heart, if there's not something human there that you relate to, you're not going to care about the characters. You're not going to bond with them. It's just like any relationship you have in life. The people that you want to spend time with are the people you care about. How do you learn to care about people? Well, you have memories that you share together. You have experiences that you've lived through together. You've bonded. And you like that person. Nobody really wants to read a book about people they don't care about. And so if there is heart absent from a story, I'm asking an awful lot of my readers to stick with me and read the story I want to tell them if I'm not giving them anything to care about.
Right.
That, to me, is right. probably one of the hardest things to write is heart, because it takes the writer understanding the reader. There are a lot of writers who have something they want to say. Those are often blog theme writers. They are speaking from first person. They have ideas they want to share. The most important thing to them is to communicate what they think about this specific subject. And often, in many cases, they're authorities in that subject. So there's a reason we go to the same blogs every time. We trust that person. We trust their voice. We want to know what they think or say about something. When you're the writer of fiction, you're the author, you're not noticeable.
You don't want to be, at
you
least.
Don't want to be, no. What you want to be noticed are the characters you're writing about. And so there is a certain amount of removing of oneself from the subject matter that I think is necessary. I think you can read a fiction book and tell when the author couldn't take himself out of it. There are usually voice problems in it. There's continuity. And there's a drive that is not compelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you're sitting listening to somebody for too long and you're just like, oh, they need to think about something else.
Right.
But if you, as an author, are able to write heart in a story, it's because you've listened to people. It's because you've noticed them. I think the best authors of heart are empathetic people. They're going to notice everybody at the party. They're going to pick up not only on what everybody is saying, but actually what they're feeling. They're going to notice all the mannerisms. And in our sin, we're going to judge them.
Right.
We're going to come to conclusions. But hopefully in our wisdom, we'll take that information and use it just to get to know that person. And I think the writers who are able to write heart into a story, they really see people.
Mm.
And that's why I think it's so hard to do. That's not everybody's gift in life.
Mm.
Not everybody wants to take in that much stimulation.
Or question their own ability to talk about it once they have it.
Mm-hmm.
You've been watching me write notes here.
Yeah.
I have so many different directions that I would love to go from this.
Well, you get to choose. You're the host.
Oh, there's too many, though. That's the problem. I want to hit all of them. You were talking about the blog writer as an example, and this bit about voice and heart. And there is this really difficult part of the craft. Now, I don't know how much a musician or an artist can, a visual artist would get out of this, but maybe they would. They probably would. I'm just going to use the wrong words for it. But there's a massive difference between me putting words on the page and what you read in those words. And at a certain point, this is where the editing task becomes so important. You have to be able to read your words not as if you wrote them, but as if you're coming to them cold, and then finding out what those words are saying, and then asking, is that what the story, the essay, whatever, is that what it needs to say? So it's a pursuit of clarity. It's why I love English, is because English has, it's also why English is so dangerous and so difficult. It has such a diverse ability with its words to go in different directions. There's so many edges to our words, and not all languages have that, but it's a difficult task. And then when you combine that with what you were getting at about observation, so to make what I've seen or experienced what you feel and experience as a reader, or as someone who sees an art piece or a musician or listening to music, that's the real task of creativity. It's not just having a feeling or wanting to do something to share, but then being able to step back from it and ask, is what I did actually what I wanted to do? And but that's the craft, right? And that's,
yes, and I think that's one of the blessings of education, and where we're very wealthy in this nation. While my education was in music, it was an education in creativity and in composition and in analysis. And so throughout my education, I had opportunity to notice a piece of music, to then pay attention to my own reaction to it and then try to figure out, why do I react that way?
Right.
In other words, really notice in the piece what's going on fundamentally, what tools are being used. And then the more you study music, the more you realize, oh, there are actual techniques that are being used.
And they call this theory, right? Yes. Yeah. But then isn't the problem with theory always that theory? Why I hated theory as a young kid taking piano. But I wanted to play because I could put heart into what I played. But the theory had no heart, right? But there's a point at which you have to get enough theory to be able to do with your heart what you want to do. That's a really fine line there.
It is. Or you could say theory is important for understanding how somebody else achieves heart.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
And so theory is a language. It's the math of music, and in understanding the language of the math of music, I can then properly analyze someone else's piece of music and then understand, how did he get me to thrill? You know, when we're watching Lord of the Rings and the lights are being, you know, the music is the whole scene of that, right?
Yeah.
How is he able to get me to feel that way? Well, part of that is I can just say, well, I really like it when this musical phrase happens. I just feel really good. Another way to analyze it is I can open up the music score and look at what mode he's in, what scales he's using, what instrumentation. So I'm looking at all the fundamentals of music. I'm looking at his melody, his rhythm, the texture, harmony, all these tools he is using to help me react a certain way. And here's the thing. That is transferable to writing.
Yeah.
Before I wrote House of Living Stones, which is the first book of the Anthems of Zion series. So, Know Thyself. I'm dumb. I'm a musician. If I want to write something that I like, well, I probably need to take a look at the things I like and analyze them. Mm. I need to diagram Anne of Green Gables. How does she introduce her main characters? In what context? Does she do that through exposition or does she do that through action? Am I getting to know the main character by the main character introducing herself? Or am I getting to know her because other characters talk about her first? In other words, I'm going to notice what techniques the author is using, and I'm going to read it and have an honest reaction of, does that work for me? Do I like that? Did I want to skip that page, or is it compelling? And same with Hammer of God. How did Bo Geertz get me to cry with Christian joy at somebody's death scene?
Hmm.
How did he do that? Well, I had to analyze that. I had to stop and go, how did he do that? Well, we could probably have whole entire discussions, you and I, about specific chapters of specific books. I won't go into that. But what I did is I took note of those techniques and decided which ones to employ in my own book and which ones not to employ. Mm. And that's the craft side of it. I wish I could say it's so romantic as just I had this wonderful inspiration and then I just, you know, bled words out of my fingers. But the truth is that, no, I was a student of the craft.
Mm.
And I took what I thought was a good idea that came from the strictures that my husband put on the situation. And then I decided to look to the best and see, how do they do it? And then I started that way. And what happened, and this is one of the things now that I'm hooked about writing, that worked for me for about 10 chapters. And then what happens is you've created this world, you've created these characters, and you know them so well at that point. All you have to do then is put them in a situation, and the book does kind of write itself.
Yeah, they act.
They do, and it's deliciously, intoxicatingly exciting to be the one beholding it happening. Mm. And so about 10 chapters in, I didn't really need to look at any other book at that point. The story had its own momentum. And I guess another way to say it is I knew what style I had chosen, because that's another thing. Maybe when we're blogging, when we're writing the first person, we're writing in our own style, right? It's our own voice. It's a style that comes from our upbringing, from everything we studied, everything we read. In writing the Anthems of Zion series, I chose a style. I chose a specific putting together of the words to evoke a certain kind of nostalgia, to tip my hat to certain authors. I was trying to create something that I thought was missing in my own reading life. But once I had chosen that style, well, then I was committed to that style for the rest of the series. That's not necessarily my natural writing voice.
Right. Right.
And that's one of the beauties of writing is you could also choose to depart from that style and pick up a different one.
Right.
And in that sense, the opportunities are endless and exciting and tantalizing.
Much like being a musician, right? Or much like an art. So we've talked about just creativity in general. And I think that's what the appeal of this conversation will ultimately be, because not everybody out there is looking to write a book. So I'm hoping that we can give people. You've touched on productivity a little bit too, which is I don't know how much people know this out there, but it's like a massive side passion of mine. I probably spend way too much time being unproductive trying to learn about productivity. I find it exhilarating.
You get sucked into those books, don't you?
I do. I find it exhilarating. And to the point where sometimes it's like, Jonathan, you just need to step back and stop being productive and not do anything. You'd get more done. but you did touch on it there, particularly in the path to getting those first 10 chapters that you were talking about, and using not just theory as theory, but theory as a tool for achieving your goal. But I know that isn't all that it takes when you're writing a book. And I know that it can't, I mean, maybe not. Maybe this is true for you. But for me, it's not, particularly with fiction. Like, yes, after I've got the characters developed, if they are just put in a situation, they're going to do what they do. But I'm not always going to sit down at a table and put them in that situation just because it's what I do. And there's this whole other edge of having to learn to manage everything about my life and day to make sure that at least four times a week, really wish it was more, at least four times a week, I've got a two-hour block that I can sit down and say hello to whoever is supposed to be talking at that moment. And that has got to be one of the most difficult things in my life. I mean, stopping sinning is harder, right? but it's amazing to me how many things rise up to challenge those moments, even when I've got those moments on the calendar, especially if I'm out of habit for even a week. Getting back into the habit is tremendously difficult.
Oh, yeah. You're retraining your brain.
So I'm curious about your habits.
Yeah. Well, they're different whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction. Every writer's different. So what I'm about to say is totally subjective.
Sure.
But nonfiction is so much easier for me to write than fiction.
Huh.
Now, fiction is creatively more satisfying for me to write than nonfiction. But nonfiction is topical. We're governed by truth. So there is a definite guidance as to what to write and what not to write. So those that governance, to me, makes it so much easier to write the nonfiction. You know, especially if we're writing about theology, right? We don't necessarily want to write something new. That's not necessarily a good thing. What we're actually trying to do is just to be as clear as we can be for the sake of the reader, that hopefully we have something to communicate that's beneficial to Christendom. And rarely is that something new, but it might be helping. Like Brian Wolfmiller, he's so good with metaphor and analogy, isn't he? I just feel like he's an avalanche, and they just keep coming, and they're so helpful, right? That for me, the layperson, they're helpful in helping me understand theology applied to my life as a Christian. For some reason, that just makes more sense to me as a communicator. It probably comes – that's a teaching technique, and I've been teaching for about 20 years, so that nonfiction communicating to teach something just comes more easily to me. Therefore, as a habit, I often, each of my nonfiction books, each chapter is its own topic. And He Remembers the Barren, each chapter is a question that a barren woman asks herself or God. And then the content of the chapter is an attempt to answer, to address that question.
That's interesting. I'm going to interrupt a little bit.
Yeah, that's
okay. Because that makes me think of the vignette thing that you were talking about earlier. Did that happen at the same time? Were you doing that kind of study at the same time?
No. No. What I will say about that is the vignettish style of writing helped me with my fiction because one of, again, the creative constraints I put on myself was I wanted to have clever chapter titles that were funny and punny and that would appeal to the intelligent reader, especially one who knows Lutheranism and hymnody very well. And so to me, having the chapter titled kept everything contained, and it didn't get out of control.
Yeah.
And by out of control, I don't mean that it reads as being controlled. I mean, it just helps you know where not to go.
Yeah.
This is not the chapter to go that direction because I want it to fit under this title. Any kind of organizational principle like that, it doesn't actually restrict you. It frees you up to write something truly excellent about that one thing.
I want to dig into that thought.
Sure.
The idea that boundaries create freedom, that constraints allow for creativity, because it's so counter to what everyone else thinks is the reality, right?
Right.
All the way to open borders these days, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like, I remember reading, I think it was, I'm going to lose his name now. He's so well known, a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, thinker, Catholic. Oh, for Pete's sake,
Tolkien? What's his name?
No, but he was, yes, but he was one of the Inklings. Okay. And, God, big mustache. Any case, someone's going to be yelling at the podcast right now that I can't, sometimes I can't think of his name.
Just tell them to yell louder. We can hear them.
Yeah, I can even. Yeah, What's Wrong with the World is one of his books. And The Man Who Was Thursday. Oh, for Pete's sake. Anyway, he I think it's in What's Wrong with the World. He talks about how a boundary unites, mm-hmm. which again is like it's a paradoxical statement, mm-hmm. right? Isn't a boundary supposed to divide? Well, yes, that's how it unites, mm-hmm. by dividing. And in the same way, a constraint sets you free, like you said it really well earlier, I think, by keeping you in this box, now you only have so many options. If you have too many options, you're never going to pick anything. I was listening to something, I don't remember where this came up just yesterday, about if you want to avoid buyer's remorse, don't look at 15 options before you buy. Look at two, mm-hmm. and pick the best of the two. And scientifically, it's been shown you're more likely to have no buyer's remorse, even if it was a worse purchase. You're going to feel better about your purchase, all because of the constriction of your freedom, creating more freedom at that moment, right? The limitations giving you more space. I want to bring that back, though, now as an idea to your time management, mm-hmm. with writing. I don't know, you know, everything else that goes on in your life, all the other commitments you have, maybe you don't have a ton. I guess I partially imagine that every day you wake up and you just sit there with your cup of coffee and you have 5 hours to write these amazing books, and I'm very jealous of that. But something tells me that's not real.
No. So my husband and I, we have not been blessed with any children. So that is a difference in our life. Mm. You wake up and you have human beings that, you know, are dependent on you for their livelihood. Mm. So I don't have that in my home. I do have that outside of my home. We have found that, you know, none of us escapes being parents in the church, right? Mm. God calls us all to be mothers and fathers. Just we aren't always given children of our own. So one of my great distractions is that I have a whole lot to do outside of our house that is centered primarily around our family life, our church life, and then also in writing books, there have been many opportunities to go out and meet a lot of people and to speak at a lot of different colleges. And I often think of them as my kids, you know, because I get to keep in touch with them and have them in my own home and talk with them. But so I have trouble insofar as like I can actually overschedule my calendar too much so that I'm not in my home,
mm-hmm.
because I don't have that thing in my home grounding me there.
Do you write in your home?
I do.
Okay.
When I am under contract, I will write in other areas because I have to. I have written in airports before. I've written in restaurants. I've written in coffee shops. Actually, coffee shop is my least favorite place to write.
That's where I have to go. Coffee shop or bar. I have to go. We're like the complete opposite.
I know, and it's
if I'm home, I can't do it.
It's because of the music. I'm a musician. It just drives me.
Well,
music,
that's what you have headphones for.
I carry earplugs with me. They're in my purse right now. But I also am a personality that absorbs other people. And so it's hard for me to not be aware of the person sitting to my right or in front of me or behind me or the barista. I'm absorbing all of that. And that's input. And when I'm writing, I need to be outputting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a focus thing. I actually, when I do write, most often it's in complete silence.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's in a space where nothing changes.
Uh-huh.
So that all I'm pointing to my brain.
Yeah.
So that everything in here can be as active as possible, as creative as possible, and not distracted by outside stimulation. Because you better believe that outside stimulation is going to influence your writing.
Right. Sure.
And music, it's not that I think that it's that you're in error if you listen to music while you're writing, but you yourself are being stimulated by mm-hmm. the music, and your reader doesn't have that same music. It doesn't have that soundtrack going on.
It's true.
So you are letting an outside influence create an emotional response in you that has nothing to do with your writing. And that, I think, is dangerous, because you need to create something that's going to stir the reader. And how can you be a good judge of if it's stirring or not if you're allowing yourself to be stirred by something else at the same time? And I've read some writings from people who listen to music, and you know, it doesn't move me.
Sure.
But maybe if the soundtrack were playing at the same time, it would.
Huh.
Yeah. And so okay. It's more out of fear. I don't want to be falsely stimulated.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the other side of it is that I am a big believer, this comes from being a musician. We call it woodshedding when you're a musician.
Not familiar with that.
When you have, you know, when you're going to have a gig and you're going to, let's say it's a jazz gig, and, you know, the person who's in charge gives you your charts for that gig. Well, I need to really woodshed that song. I need to close up in the shed and get to know those chord changes really well. Because if I'm going to have to improvise on top of those chord changes, I need to know.
Yeah, them. Right. Yeah. Got to internalize it deep.
And that takes repetition. It takes practice. It takes sleep. You know, you have to have some good sleeps on it so your brain can truly process it.
It's a whole nother fun topic right
it
there.
It is. It totally is. But I have found that writing is another, and this is, again, maybe where being a musician helps. I already have that habit built in that I know. Okay, let me put it this way. Kevin Hildebrand, dear man, let's say he hands me, you know, Katie, we're going to do BWV 106 for Good Shepherd Institute this year. Would you do the soprano solo? I would love to. I will get the score for that music and I'll immediately have a panic moment because there are certain intervals at a certain speed that I'm not used to singing and I know that I cannot do it.
Hmm.
Well, that doesn't matter. What matters is you need to learn to do it. And this is where time and experience comes in. I know that if I practice that interval, I'm training my brain and my muscles how to do that. And if I do that over a long period of time with lots of good sleeps, I'm going to learn how to do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so I know that I have to put in the work, though. I'm going to practice for a half hour that first day, and I'm not going to feel any effect of it. I'm going to be in the same panic state. I still can't do it. And then, I don't know, six rehearsals into it, suddenly I can do it. And what I've learned over time as a musician is that you can do these things, but you have to work at it and you have to train your brain to do it. So with writing, I try to train my brain to perform at a certain time of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Does that always work? No. Do I always keep that schedule? No. But when I start writing a book, I'm going to pick a space and I'm going to decide that I'm going to write there.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I'm going to write, I'm going to sit there to write, and I am not going to do anything else at that space because I don't want my brain to think, oh, I need to answer emails or, oh, I need yep. to pay bills. No, no, no. I want my brain to know that when I sit in this spot, it's time to be creative. And then, so I will train it through location.
Mm-hmm.
Next, I will train it through time of day. It's not always been the same time of day, depending on the book. What matters is what season of life am I in? I'll look at my calendar and I'll realize, you know what? We're going to have the church women's Bible study and all this. Morning's not going to be the best time. So I'm going to train myself that as soon as I finish eating lunch.
Sit down, do it.
I'm going to sit down in that space and yep. I'm going to do it. Or what works for me the best is, I'm a wife, so my time is not necessarily my own right when I get up. I'm going to get up, I'm going to take care of my husband's and my needs for the day. And then when he walks out that door and when this dish is done, I don't care what I want to do. I'm going to go sit and I'm going to write. And it sucks. Can I say that word?
Yeah, because you just, I want to come back. Yeah, absolutely. You can say yeah. whatever you want. Not what I want to do. See, and this is such an interesting thing.
Because you know what the result of that is, right? Like if we apply it to the music situation. After 2 weeks of this, what's going to happen? Oh, my brain's going to do it all on its own.
Yeah,
all I have to do is sit down.
If you push through it.
Yeah, if you push through it.
But the fact that you're starting a task because you want to do it in the first place. I want to write a book. And then as soon as you are into it a little ways, I don't want to do it.
Uh-huh.
But you still do want to do it. But every time you try to sit down, you don't want to do it. And
flesh is weak.
Yeah, right. Have you ever read The War of Art?
Yes.
Yeah.
Twice.
Yeah. Speaking of language, I think he's got some bombs he drops in there. But
he does. Yes.
But it is a wonderful mind experiment in this shared problem that all creative people, producers of creative things, have, where we don't want to do the thing we want to do the most. And so in some ways, the productivity conversation is just a way to talk about what habits, what tricks you have to fool yourself into doing what you know you really want to do. But for some reason, you have this resistance there, mm-hmm. sitting there fighting back. So I find that interesting, not because I didn't think you would have that, but then to hear your side of it. I want to jump back onto music again just for a second, because I really like the theory you shared. It makes a lot of sense. But I'm so different. I always have to listen to music, not because I listen to it. It actually, but see, I probably am being influenced.
You've trained your brain.
But it zones me out.
Yeah, you use it for that reason. Yeah.
But I always, it's certain kinds of music. There's no words. Uh-huh. For Pete's sake, there's no words. And then it's the same music. Like, I have a fairly large playlist, but it's the same playlist. So I'm in the same music over, sometimes I'll even put on the same piece. It just runs nonstop on repeat because I'm not listening to it. But what it does, and it makes the analogy that I compare this to is, you know how, I mean, I don't know, actually, maybe you don't. And I don't mean this in a cruel way, but an infant, when they are overexposed to input, will just turn off. Mm-hmm. Bam, they go to sleep. Right. And it's like, they're so loud in here. How could they be sleeping? It's because there's just too much input.
And then they wake up at 2 a.m. Yeah,
and
scream.
Out. Right. But it's almost like that's what I'm able to do when I go to a coffee shop and put on my headphones and listen to the same music, is that for the first time, I don't have to think about email. Mm-hmm. I'm not worried about how I should be doing something for the congregation. I'm not worried about my kids. And it is this weird bubble I can put myself in. But I'm scared now that the music is still influencing what I'm writing. So you got me worried about it.
Well,
a little bit.
And you know, and it may not be, because honestly, you've trained your brain, you're triggering it, right? Mm-hmm. It's your trigger. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Like, that's a legit trigger.
Yeah.
It is. And you and I could probably switch places, where if I spent 2 weeks training myself to trigger with music, I could probably write through the music. And if you trained it with silence, you could do the same thing.
I'd have to combine the silence and the space though.
Yeah.
That is really, really clever. But that's the trick too, though, is you only have so many spaces in the world to choose from.
And that's true.
Yeah.
And I have chosen different spaces over time, which is also why I don't prefer to write in the airport, because it's out of my...
Yeah.
I only do that because I have to sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's where deadlines are a blessing. They force you out of your comfort zone sometimes.
Right.
But and here's... sorry, I'm going way back.
That's right.
Here's where nonfiction and fiction are different. I can write nonfiction in an airport, no problem.
Hmm.
Fiction, though, there are so many things in the balance with fiction that at some point, I'd say like 2/3 through your story, it's so big. It's deliciously big. It's not bad big, but you're so in this other world that's not reality.
Right.
And it's so much to keep in mind that anything that takes you out of that, you lose steam, you lose momentum.
Yep.
So to try to have that while I'm sitting in the airport with all these people, it makes me want to cry. I'm so frustrated.
I think the vignette approach to nonfiction has spared you, because I have the same problem with theology.
Uh-huh.
But because I'm trying to write this
from
big
here
thing. Yeah.
To end. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. It's brutal. Hmm. It's brutal. Right now, the thing I'm trying to work on, it's like I'm beating my brain against a wall. I've gone back to look at the front end of it, and I'm not even sure what's going on, because I know where I was with only about a chapter or so to go to the end. And oh man, to hold the thing together, suddenly it's like heart surgery. You go and you just start ripping out things, you know, that's terrible. Throw that away, which is much easier to do when you've been away from it for a while. But at the same time, it's like, what a waste of time all that other writing was, all that effort. Although
a good writer, I think, will tell you that, no, you had to write the bad writing to get to the good writing, right? That's part of how it works. But so I have the same problem with theology writing, nonfiction writing. And so I can't do it. And I can't do anything near purpose besides watch a movie. It's like, I gotta sit there and watch a movie. It's just awful.
It's just self-coping, right?
Like... Yeah, pretty much. I got to get through this, so I'm going to do it. But so I want to come back, though, to nonfiction a little bit and combine a couple of things we've talked about. Sort of as a complaint, and I haven't read your nonfiction, so this is not about your writing.
And you never have to, Patrick. No. It's okay, because I don't even know, unless you like Anne of Green Gables, you may not like it. No. But
one of my biggest problems, I don't want to say it's my problem. I think a major problem that the Lutheran confession has in 21st century America is that much of our theology writing does not have heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I know why that is or how that is.
Yep.
And what you said earlier is very important. We don't want to write anything new, but it's almost like as a result of that, we've decided to not write anything new.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, see, and I mean two different things. That's the beauty of English, right? I mean two different things with that.
Yeah.
But so the challenge to figure out as a writer, and I think, you know, my works, I feel like Broken tried. It did touch some people in certain ways. It was young and zealous, and I wouldn't write that book again the way I wrote it now or wrote it then. Echo, I don't know if it's got enough heart. I think Echo has a great substance and a clever trick that helps. It's a good analogy. It's a lot of good analogy.
Yeah.
But
good for teaching.
But it's not going to help you handle suffering, right?
Okay.
I don't think it will. Maybe it will, but I don't think it will. Why is it that we don't write books about justification that people can't wait to read because it helps them handle suffering, right? That's my ultimate question. I'm not sure you have an answer, but I'm curious your own.
I think you know what book to write. Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Seriously. And it's because it's hard, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes a lot of, it takes listening. People don't want to listen to each other. They don't want to notice what somebody's true problem is. And how can we write something that helps that person if we haven't first noticed what they struggle with? And so I think for there to be heart, even in a proclamation of something deeply theological, we have to know the sinner.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know the person who's suffering. And for one, who wants to go hang out with somebody who's suffering, right? That's part of the problem.
Sure.
Two, we're afraid of the person who's suffering. Like, we kind of treat suffering as a disease, like it might be catching. So
yeah.
We avoid those who are suffering as we do those who are sick. Also, we're, especially here in, you know, Central and Midwest America, we're kind of Methodist Lutheran. So we're wrapped up in this glory language, and we're afraid to admit suffering ourselves because that might be a sign of God's disfavor. All these things were preconditioned that make us not want to look suffering in the face. And therefore, our stories, I think, are not as powerful because they're not as true. They're not really addressing the things that universally we are all terrified about.
Mm-hmm.
They're not addressing the things that that we all know deep down inside. Geertz did.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And that's what I'm trying to do in House of Living Stones and The Choir Mortal and The Harvest Raised. In House of Living Stones, I'm trying to address the atrocity of gossip, not just like in a, you know, oh, the church ladies gossip, though that's part of the fun of it, right?
Right.
Fun meaning like we all know that scenario and we can identify it and laugh at it and we're at home in it, sadly. But what does that actually do to somebody when their reputation is ruined? And in the church, what an atrocity that is.
Sure.
And apart from forgiveness in Christ, there's nothing to heal that situation. I wanted to address that because it's a rampant problem. I'm sure it's a rampant problem all across Christendom, but in the LCMS, it's terrible. It's absolutely terrible.
I think it's humanity. It's, what was terrible is that we would be able to have the Eighth Commandment in our catechism described as well as it is and quote it at each other as a way to continue doing
the very thing that it says we shouldn't do. We just using the best things in the worst possible way.
Or how even like we just are so quick to accuse other people of breaking the Eighth Commandment when we in our own hearts and minds are ruining that person's reputation right away and breaking it ourselves. Just what does it mean to despise? What does it mean to forgive? And then in Choir Mortal, I wanted to address grief compounding. The House of Living Stones has grief in it, but I choose not to talk about it too much because I never want to know too much about a story.
Sure.
Part of what I love about reading is the puzzle of it, finding the foreshadowing and figuring it out. But in Choir Immortal, I think it would be a poor story about the church indeed if I did not include our brothers and sisters in Christ whose griefs compound, because rarely does just one bad thing happen, and usually it's several things at once. And what does it mean to notice somebody's grief and to care for them? And what does it mean to fail them? Because we do both. Thanks be to God in Christ, we do care for each other. He prepares those good works for us to do and he completes them in us. Thanks be to God. But basically, we're terrible people and we fail all the time. And what is that saint center life in the church? And then Harvest Raise, I wanted to talk about the very hard thing, which is we don't really want to take care of the people God gives us to take care of. We want to take care of somebody else on a magazine cover or in another nation. And not that there's anything wrong with caring for those who live in different across our borders. What I'm saying is that we in our sin don't really want to serve our neighbors. But in the church, God gives us very specific, terrible, wonderful people to serve. And what does that look like? What does that mean? Who is our neighbor?
Is the only way to get into that kind of level of heart through fiction? Again, this is still my question. Because as you talk about Geertz again, the characters become real in part because of what they face and what they deal with. Much of what, and see, I'm gonna tangent a little, but because I want to bring up this note, much Christian fiction is really bad writing because it doesn't have heart. It's cheesy. It doesn't deal with real things. So I find myself increasingly drawn to secular works, not because I like their worldview, but because their worldview at least is more honest about the world we live than much Christian stuff.
Absolutely. Right?
So swinging that back around, it's like there's something about the way we speak dogmatically. It's not that the dogmatics are the problem. But something about the way we use the dogmatics or the way we hide behind the dogmatics is maybe a better way to say it, that keeps us from being able to apply our theology in book form, in written form, in such a way that someone would pick it up and say, this is real. We don't, sadly. Amazingly, though, I will say, as I've picked up and read older American Lutheran theology, Crowth, Porterfield Crowth, or even Francis Pieper, I get more real out of them than I do out of a lot of more modern works. The modern works were just so sterilized in the way we approach it. It's all very high up. I don't know if we've just tried to be too much like the broader publishing house. You know, every chapter has a neat little story at the front and then a little moral lesson you learn by the if that style and theory is just dominating us too much. I don't know. And I'm asking these things and saying these things because I don't know. I don't have an answer. I don't expect you to like fix it for me, but I think it's worth pondering
And I don't know. I don't know if I'm smart enough to say that fiction is the best tool for combining heart and theology, but I will say it's an effective tool.
Yeah.
As you pointed out, though, it can also be ineffective.
Yeah.
And God help us to write stories that are an effective tool. But where I think fiction is an opportunity for combining the two, is not the concept of manipulation. It's not like, oh, I'm going to put my characters in this situation so that they can experience this. No, it's the listening again. What really happens in people's lives? Where do they encounter these trials? What do their families say to them when this happens? What poisonous pesticides are put down on the ground where the sower has put the seed that keep the faith from growing? Like addressing the thorns, addressing, you know, the rocks, and addressing the fertile soil. Like a good story is the parable of the sower. it's not a true Christian fictional story
right.
if you don't hit all those points. Because that's what real life is. Jesus has told us this is actually what it's like in the church. And here's the one who believes, and here's everybody else who doesn't. Well, that's actually there are your elements of the story.
Hmm.
That's the truth that needs to be in there. And fiction gives you opportunity to write about the entire landscape. And probably where craft comes in, and where some fiction is excellent and some isn't, is, well, who's been listening well enough to write a real story?
Hmm.
And by real, I don't mean that it can't be fantasy or a different world. Part of, I think, of why we love fantasy is that it actually is a funnel.
It's a restriction.
It is. It brings into focus that kernel of truth that's mm-hmm. universal. Yeah. And so whether you're creating a fantastical world or whether you're writing about Central Illinois, I think the funnel is the same, though. Like, the whole point is to bring us to that truth that's written on every man's heart so that when they come upon it, they recognize it. What we can't control is how they're going to react to it. Is their sure. heart going to harden? Are they going to be moved to repentance and faith? Are you going to get a really terrible review by the Calvinist who doesn't understand the Lord's Supper?
Right.
Or are you going to have somebody write a review that said, wow, I'm going to go to Lutheran church now because that matches what I read in the Word of God. You know, like, you just, we can't control all of that, but what we can try to do is be a really good funnel.
Which I think that brings it back to listening now, not just to people, but to listening to the word
yes.
yourself, right?
Yeah. And which is where I feel inept, pastor.
Oh.
I'm not a pastor. Yeah. I don't have a seminary.
Well, being
education.
A pastor doesn't make you... What's the opposite of inept? Ept? Doesn't make you ept.
You are so ept.
Apt. So I think it's apt, right? well, no, because you never... The moment you would believe you know it is the moment you're in great danger. It's so deep and so complex, and you forget. I think Reed Lessing, when he was at the seminary... not specifically said this. He was talking about something else, but it's very much connected. He said that, you know, we got a problem. We leak. Mm-hmm. We leak the Holy Spirit. And so we need that Spirit to be put back into us.
I had an image.
That's
powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, what I like about that, okay, I want to mix it with, so we leak the Holy Spirit, but it's a puddle of grace we leave behind us everywhere we go.
Oh, yeah. Write it down.
Well, that one's up here.
Okay, good.
I've used it too many times.
You're getting more sleep than me. You're remembering things better than I am.
Brian Wolfmuller has also challenged me on this. We're kind of getting near the end here, but this is on the aptness. He had noticed in my life over the last 5 years, and I don't know what caused this, but he didn't accuse me in like a direct way. This is just in conversation. I kind of figured out this is what he thought, and I really appreciate it, that somehow my imagination ceased to be as excited by theology as it had once been. And so he attributes my hankering for productivity as a boredom with Scripture. And I think he's right. And I mean, I think we all have something in some way in which we do this. But that gets back to, you know, your thing about being inept. To be apt is to be to have your imagination hungering for what the Scriptures say. And so he and I don't remember where this was either. I had taken that language of imagination, and in an interview about Echo another place, I had used the idea that, you know, the goal of Echo was to open people's imagination to the Scriptures. And someone got really upset about that language, as if I meant, like, we're going to get the Spirit through imagining new things or something weird like that. But I want to attribute it to Brian and then say I think he's right, that the task of theology is a task of imagination. Not that we're going to make it up, but that the human mind has to be renewed and inspired to hunger for this. And for better or for worse, you know, I'm on the journey I'm on. You're on the journey you're on. I don't think you need to be who I am. If I was, then you wouldn't be writing what you write, right?
That's
right?
True.
And the insights you have as the theologian that you are, and theologian just means one who knows God, right? One who has knowledge of God. It's not about being able to write dogmatic texts. We don't need more dogmatic textbooks. That's kind of my point. We need less of that. We need to be able to take those dogmatics and apply them to life. And so the theologian that you are is what has enabled you to write in such a way that my wife and my daughter have been inspired, like literally inspirited, had the spirit given to them through the confession that you make in your stories. And that's great.
Well, all glory to our Lord, because that would bless me greatly to think that these books would be a help to the church.
What's your next project?
Oh, well, you know what? I do have one in mind. And I'm not trying to be mysterious. I can't talk about it yet just because, but it is fiction.
It's fiction? Okay.
It's fiction. I'm very excited about fiction.
Can you say whether it's new or in the same world it was before?
Totally new.
Totally new.
Totally new. I just have to have some conversations with some people before I can talk about it more fully.
Sure.
But I've had a few different ideas, and I've been trying to take some time. Last year was writing and editing He Restores My Soul, and then working on some hymn texts with cantor Christina Roberts. And so last year was not a fiction year. It was a very nonfiction kind of year. And I've been trying to pace myself, and by pace myself, I mean give some distance to the fictional world of Bradbury that I had lived in for a good 6 years. Just trying to pay respect to that creative world by putting some distance in between me and it. Not because I don't love it. It's because I love it so much. I want to respect it by leaving it right where it is. But therefore, then I've had this last year to kind of think through some ideas, and my husband knows all of them. And he is my love and my leader and my pastor and my friend. And I had settled on one of two ideas, and he liked one better than the other. He thought this particular one would be most helpful to the church. Unfortunately, my creative juices just got all stirred up by the other one.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, but then what happened is about a week ago, it was actually Thanksgiving. And this is, again, one of the blessings of creativity. Sometimes you're just waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're waiting, right?
Yeah.
And on our drive down to see Mom and Dad Schuerman, it just within like 5 seconds became very clear and it's neither of those ideas.
Oh, interesting.
It's something totally different. And it's something that marries many of the things I feel like have been in the works for many years. And it combines all of them. And I'm excited. And what happened then, and this is how I knew it was probably the thing I'd be doing, is my brain just, it lit up. It was on fire.
Had
I
to
couldn't
work on it.
Stop it. Like the whole time I'm sitting with a group of people, and this is what happens with fiction, your brain just, your subconscious works on it. You can't stop it. It just, and all you can do is hope you have something nearby to write this stuff down.
Oh, that's cool.
It is a blessing. So yeah. I'm hoping maybe in the next month I can talk about
it. Yeah, that's really cool. I want to close this, but that makes me think about what I'm working on right now, because my biggest frustration is it's something I wanted to write 10 years ago really bad.
Uh-huh.
And it sat there, and I want to finish it, darn it.
Let me ask you this.
But I'm not inspired by it right now. But okay. I am, but I'm not. And it drives me crazy.
Here's
it's so close. It's so close.
Sometimes we want to finish something just because we want to be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we want to finish something because it's in us and it has to get out. Which is it?
It's like in the middle.
Okay. Then I would say...
It's probably the latter.
Not the thing, right? Is it the latter?
No, I'm sorry, the former.
Okay, because then here's I think, is the test of a true artist.
It's so good for the church.
Okay, see, and that's hard, too. Here's the thing. Life is so short.
Yeah.
There are so many things
you
could write,
right?
But you just articulated in this interview something that's necessary. Why don't we have a compelling story about justification that also has heart? I mean, there's something that's needed.
Yeah.
But sometimes we have to just let go of the thing that's nagging us, because that's our flesh saying, I just want to have it done, you know?
Yeah.
And sometimes creatively, there are other things to write. And I would say, it sounds like you're in a waiting period of trying to figure that out.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I've also been able to get really close to having this thing done, not as, and this is the thing, I mean, I'll say this right now on the podcast, if I get this done in the next 2 or 3 months, which I think I could.
Okay.
People who've read Broken and Echo are going to be like, man, that book kind of wasn't very good, the new one. Because it won't be with the heart that these did.
Yeah.
But it will have the potential to hit someone who doesn't care about Jonathan Fisk at all and give them an answer or a way to look at the Lord's Supper that will help them embrace what the scriptures say. So it's sort of like a little bit of a sacrifice
and I don't mean that like to pat myself on the back, but it's kind of like, no, I got to scuttle the ship on this one. It's all there. It's good for the world. Suck it up, Jonathan. Write it.
Okay.
And then get back to what I really want to do.
What, end of November?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say by Ash Wednesday, can you get that thing done?
I think so.
Oh, it's time. Do it. You're going to find your space. You're going to find your time of day and you're just going to do it and it's going to stink and you're going to hate it, yeah. But just get it done.
3 o'clock in the afternoon, unfortunately, is the time. I tried converting it to 6 a.m. in the morning, but I couldn't do that one either.
You need a special coffee for that time in the afternoon. There needs to be something special that you can look forward to that's going to be a part of your triggering.
Yeah. I'm gonna work on that a little more, having the same thing. Because you're right, because my morning coffee is what, and I usually don't want that at 3 in the afternoon.
Okay, something else. Something that you only get when you're writing.
Okay.
It's time to train that brain.
Okay. I like that too.
Do it. Okay. Well, I'm going to be asking you on Ash Wednesday.
Well, do we know what that date is? No.
No.
Off the top of your head. It's late this year. It might be in March.
Don't you hope it's March?
No, I don't. I want to be done. I want to get done. I really think I can do it. Anyway, that's a long story. We don't want to talk too much more about that. But I mean, that was there as a goal anyway.
Yeah.
But giving me Ash Wednesday as an actual date.
Do it and just
a nice
be done
thing.
With it. Like be done. And then your Lenten discipline can be starting your justification novel.
Oh, I don't know if I've got a justification novel. I've got, and this is the tear it up part here too. I got this fiction thing, Earth, which it's just been so long since I've been able to work on
it.
Is
that separate than this one we were just talking about? Is Earth separate?
Yeah, totally.
Oh,
because the
okay.
one where, yeah, Earth is a fiction novel.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably like 10 years old now, but I've still touched on it every year for those 10 years, whereas this other work was like gone and then I brought it back. And I don't know what the heart of Earth is mm-hmm. quite anymore because I haven't been able to give the attention to it that I want to. But when I go back and I read the opening part that is done. Oh my goodness.
You love it.
It's a great book.
Yeah. See,
oh,
it gets you excited.
Book. It's what I want to read. It's,
okay.
it's like, I want other people to write fiction like this.
Uh-huh.
What it doesn't do, what it won't do because it is a fantasy world is it doesn't allow for the direct quotation of scripture.
Okay.
There's not going to be,
there's no Judeo-Christian.
You need to believe in Jesus Christ
to
be saved because they don't live on earth. Earth is the character, not the place.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's his name. But it will be more, so it's more like in the Tolkien-Lewis direction, where there's significant Christian themes underneath it. So
is it allegory?
No.
Good.
No.
I just whispered good.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong with allegory, it's just, of course, allegory has been done when it comes to Christ and his life. Right?
Not pure, I mean, I don't like pure allegory, like Pilgrim's Progress.
Mm-hmm.
That's allegory, right? Narnia verges on allegory. Tolkien, I wouldn't call it allegory at all.
No.
And yet you got the king returning with his hosts of resurrected people to conquer the enemy, right?
Yeah.
So there's pieces like that that just bleed into it, literally. So I don't know. And this gets into discussions with publishers who maybe this isn't something all publishers would want to have, right? And so that we haven't talked about that at all. But
and you know, different publishers are like people. They have their strengths. You know, I think one thing I really appreciated with Concordia Publishing House is they have a long history with organizations like LWML. They have good relationships with readers, and it's a blessing to be on their team insofar as like getting to participate in that community. Emmanuel Press and Lutheran Legacy both had extremely high standards of theology and in production, commissioning Lutheran artists and things like that. And so one of the blessings of having, like, especially my books that have to do with infertility ethics, you know, it's great to have them under, you know, a publisher and editor who very strong theologically. And so it's a blessing to have different publishing houses with different strengths and different audiences. So like you said, something like that maybe would probably appeal to a different audience.
It's not written for Christians to read.
Interesting.
It's written for humans who like fantasy to read. A soft apologetic, though,
mm-hmm.
Wanting to insert significant elements of the Christian worldview into the American discourse through the back door. And we need more of that as we see our country increasingly dominated by entitlement ethics, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need more duty and honor and
virtue.
Charity,
mm-hmm.
yeah, virtue, those kinds of things. And at the heart of it, there's no good story without suffering and sacrifice.
Okay, and I think you just hit upon it. That's heart. virtue. If there's no virtue in the story, it doesn't have the heart.
Yeah,
it just doesn't. And I think we just have a lot of stories, a lot of generations of people who've been raised without these examples of virtue, and so they don't know to write them.
Yeah.
But boy, I miss them in the story when they're not there, don't you?
Yeah, I do. It makes me wonder, you know, if is that what when I ask what's wrong with Lutheran theological writing today, and I don't want to accuse any one writer out there or any one author of it. I just know that there's a lot that's been written that I've tried to read and I haven't been able to get through because I'm just not inspired by it. Mm-hmm. Is it virtue that's missing? What is the virtue that's missing? I don't know. I mean, God, that gets at something else. Is the virtue suffering? Mm-hmm. And
I'm attracted to the topic of suffering because I, you know, being barren, there's this constant discipline from my Lord in my life. So I can't imagine a story without that.
Right.
I can't imagine, my life and the way that I've learned, it's this, no one ever wants to be barren. It's a terrible thing. It's never a good thing, right? Children are a gift from the Lord, a heritage. They're the good thing. But at the same time, I have a hard time imagining not being barren because I've gotten to know God so clearly through this cross that in some ways, it's not that the cross is precious to me, but everything he has taught me through it is so precious. That is a gift he's given me. And so I have a hard time imagining a character who isn't being disciplined by the Lord in some way.
Right.
And so that's, I think, why I'm drawn to that writing is right. That just can't imagine that.
Stan Lee just died 2 weeks ago. I don't know if you know who Stan Lee is. No? Probably the most prolific comic book creator in the last 50 years. Marvel, all Captain America, Spider-Man, Wolverine, like all these characters are ultimately connected to Stan Lee.
And is he the director, the producer, or like the artist?
He was writer and artist, writer and illustrator. Okay. And worked with others, so it wasn't always...
Captain America?
Initially, yes, I believe so.
Wow.
Spider-Man is his like favorite number one pure creation, because a lot of the other work was, the way Marvel worked, was team stuff. So they'd be working with people, but he was kind of behind so much of that. And it changed. I was listening to Albert Mohler, Southern Baptist president of the Southern Baptist Seminary, was covering this in his podcast. He does a podcast every day for about 20 minutes on news and events from a Christian worldview. And he was covering Stan Lee's life. And I love Marvel stuff. I love Marvel movies. I love heroes because of the virtue, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But
self-sacrifice.
What was really, really fascinating that Mohler brought out that I didn't know was the history of comic books and why Marvel was able to take off at the time that it did and had everything to do with the way Stan Lee changed his characters. Before that time period, out of some of the Red Scare, communist fear, all comic books were basically these characters that were really flat, wooden, perfect 1950s Americans, like that image that we think of when we think of 50s. Uh-huh. So the good guy never did anything that wasn't purely good. White hat, shoot the guy in the hand, all that kind of stuff. It's not that Stan Lee made them anti-heroes. He just gave them doubts.
Made them human.
Yeah. Huh. And as a result, Marvel just exploded. You know, who is Spider-Man? He's a kid. He's a high school kid. He doesn't know what he's doing, but then he's out there fighting. But because he's got to. He's got to do that. Go stop the guy. And that's – how do we get onto that? but I think it's having characters that doubt.
We can relate to.
Isn't
that us? Aren't we?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who have imperfections and are honest about them. And that – I don't know. What is the character in a theology book? What is the character in a book in which we just treatise justification? How do you have somebody who's human appropriate that without having someone to relate to in it if it's not the author? And then if the author is not able to speak it in such a way that it relates, why? I don't know if that's just a theory question or not. And I don't know if it's your bailiwick at all. But it means something to me because I think what we have in the confession of the Lutheran faith, the biblical faith, is worth sharing. And I just feel like it hasn't been much shared by us.
And it's what you know. So you should write about it.
Yeah.
It's what you know.
I keep trying. Keep trying.
But you know what? It's just a time factor, right? It takes time to write a book.
You mentioned earlier, you only have so much life. So I've started looking at it this way. It's like, okay, I got another, I don't know, maybe 30 years. If I can do one book every 2 to 3 years, which ones am I going to write? Because I've got more that I want to, right? You got to start picking.
Right. Right. And there's a responsibility there, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I don't mean that like what we do is super important, but I mean like, yes, it's you want to be a good steward, right?
It is super important in that it's not that what I do is so super important, except for that in the vocation I'm in, I've been given that I should do it. So whoever's listening has the same responsibility to pick and choose what the most important tasks are in their vocations and in their life. And so I don't think it's really just about you and me being being that, but for all of us, realizing the, well, learning to number our days and then pick the tasks that we believe, it's a combination of we believe are the best for the world, but that also do inspire us because that's where then we're going to put the effort into it and all that.
That's that imagination you're talking about a little bit.
We could probably continue this conversation for a while longer.
I think so.
So you'll have to come back and visit my wife again.
That sounds good to
me. And we'll have to do this again at some time. You know what would be, I would really love to do this. It'd be crazy. I'd love to have her and you at the same time.
Ooh.
I don't know why, but I feel like there'd be something good. She doesn't like to talk about herself, but I feel like she has things she could share and you could drag it out of her.
Let me drag it out of Meredith. Yeah. I would love to.
So let's plan
She's
on that.
She's a wise woman. She is. Mm. You're giving me a smile. She is. She is so wise, and she's a listener. You have a wife who notices people.
Yes.
And therefore, I think when she reads something, she can tell if the characters are true or not.
Yeah.
And so her recommendation means the world to me.
Oh, good.
So thank you.
Glad to hear that. She definitely sees things that I don't, and I'm very thankful. Thankful for that. So Katie Schuurman, if people want to find you, where should they go find you?
Probably the easiest place is katieschuurman.com. Katie is K-A-T-I-E, and Schuurman is S-C-H-U-E-R-M-A-N-N. That has all of my books, as well as upcoming events, and you can find both of my blogs there as well. Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, no, this has been
you.
Fun. I've enjoyed it. I do look forward to doing it again sometime soon. Yeah.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.